Class war, class war.
Now,
class
Jim, war. Show this gentleman how you can dance and sing.
My attitude towards the Western powers. If you want to say there's no rules, fine. Don't go crying for your money when that comes.
America today finds herself in a unique situation. She's the only country in history in a position to become involved in a bloodless revolution.
If America does not respond creatively to the challenge to banish racism, some future historian will have to say that a great civilization died because it lacked the soul and commitment to make justice a reality for all men.
When the system doesn't work for the majority of the people, you gotta change the system.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, it's your brother, Brian Mandeez. Welcome to this emergency Class War Battlefield podcast episode. I don't know if I've ever uttered those words before that statement, but I'm telling the truth when I say it is an emergency episode. I post my episodes in two primary locations, radioforall.net. Radio, the number 4, all.net, and on Anchor FM. On radioforall.net, I already have a series posted for the next 3 weeks. Two of them posted at the beginning of the year, and then one's going to post every week from over the coming 2 weeks. I posted all 4 episodes on radioforall.net because one of the radio stations that actually periodically runs my episodes, they download it from there. So, I didn't expect to do any. Well, I was going to prepare another episode, or a couple of episodes for Martin Luther King Day and then beyond, but this one was not expected, obviously, because who could have seen this coming? Now, I'm going to break this up a little bit today. But I want to have this discussion with you. And I want to start off, obviously this is going to be about the storming of the Capitol. I know you're probably sick of it, but as you know, I don't look at things the way other people do. I never have. So I want to start off with a couple of points here. And this is kind of to temper some of the things that I've been hearing chased around by some progressives who want to remain optimistic and hopeful in the face of something that could really, really, really quickly spiral out of control. Particularly Michael Moore, whom, man, do I respect, and I was so happy to see that he posted a video the night of the siege, because Michael Moore, better than most anybody I have seen, taps into the anger and taps into the frustration and thus taps into the thinking process, because he still thinks like a working man. He's probably one of the few people in Hollywood that still do. And I'm talking about among the wealthier people there. But he taps into that, and he's able to communicate it clearly without stumbling over it. And so I was eager to hear what he had to say about his white brethren. Because though I know from living amongst you guys for a long time, and on, you know, varying levels being accepted in and pushed out of your society, he knows you because he is you. You are willing to say things around him that you're not willing to say around me. So I was intrigued to hear what he had to say. And he hit a lot of notes that I thought he would hit. I'm not going to get into most of those. But I do want to discuss one point that he brought up, which I've been hearing a lot about over the last 3 years, and that point is a generational shift to something better. A generational shift to something better. A belief that all the problems in this society rests with baby boomers. And that as baby boomers age out and die, which is going to take about 30, 40 years, the world's going to get better. I don't believe that, and particularly when it comes to the United States, and here's why. The problem isn't just the baby boomers. The baby boomers have now had an impression on two generations. And they are likely to have an impression on a third generation. This means that the echo of the baby boomer generation is going to probably last the rest of the century. Yes, it'll decrease, it'll get quieter, but it'll still be there. Moreover, the problems of today did not start with the baby boomer generation. The problems of today did not start with the baby boomer generation. They didn't start with the World War II generation, which I refuse to call the greatest generation. They didn't start with the World War I generation. They started with the inception of the colonies in this country. One point that is often overlooked when it comes to history is this, particularly history of the United States. Though the history is told as an extension from person to person, so there are individuals which are glorified. And though sometimes those persons are extended outward to a specific group, but they're always the leaders of the group, the country really exists as an organism of collectives that are themselves a collective. What I mean by this is instead of viewing the country as individual people making impressions, what really needs to be seen, or how we really need to see these things, is these are individual nuclei in a bigger mass organism. And especially when you start looking at America as that, an organism, a civilizational organism, then what you see is that, yes, you had points of influence, points of inflection. But just like you have a quarterback on a football team, particularly on an offense, without the other 10 players, that quarterback is nothing. And in other words, without the structure surrounding that person, that nucleus, without the cell which surrounds the person, which may be looked at as a society, a organization, an association, a political party, a particular portion of a political party, a city, a industry, a market, a philosophical structure, without that cell and the other cells that surround it, that make it a tissue and then make it an organ, nothing happens. I don't know if you understand what I'm trying to say here. One person did not conquer the West, even though stories are often told through the eyes of one person. 20 people did not conquer what is present-day Ohio. It took an apparatus to do that. It wasn't two or three people that cheated the Native Americans out of their land in Oklahoma or Dakota or Wyoming. It took an apparatus to do that. And then, not only did it take an apparatus to do it, but it took a willing populace to sign on to it and to say, nope, this is right. This is okay. This is fine. That's the problem that has never been addressed in this country. Is you have had 90% of the white population, maybe, if you know, I suppose if I'm thinking about it, because it wouldn't be at all true to say 90%, 70%, probably more closer to 80% of the white population signing on to what the 1 to 2% have told them to do. And you've always had this. We celebrate the unions that rose in during the Great Depression at the behest of the New Deal. The New Deal encouraged them to do it. But what we failed to look at is that 20 years earlier, the majority of the American population, which should have been pro-union to the core because of how bad corporations treated them, the majority of them were duped by the press, by the media, which was owned most of the time by the wealthy. They were duped by the press into believing that democracy, which is expressed in unionization, straight unionization, that is true democracy. They were duped and they signed on as accomplices to not only shut down union halls, but to run unions out of their cities and their communities. This has been a long-standing problem. You have had a large percentage of the European population living in this country. And I know a lot of white people don't like to think of themselves as that, but yeah, you're still European. Who hold above all else hierarchy because they believe at some time or another they're going to ascend that hierarchy. One of the cruelest ironies, which obviously FDR was aware of the New Deal, is that it reinforced that notion that if you are good, you don't question things, you just, you know, play by the rules that the wealthy want you to play by, yes, you will be rewarded. And the predictable, even though it wasn't very predictable because, well, yeah, it was predictable. The predictable result of this was McCarthyism, where the people who believed themselves to have played by the rules turned against those who they were told by the media, by the wealthy, were the people who sought to break the rules and did not want to play by the rules, which the wealthy had set up. It was predictable because the majority of Americans, the majority of Europeans living in this country, could not fathom that for generations the mythology that they believed in wasn't true. It seems the longer Europeans are here, you know, if they can trace their generations back, you know, seven generations and what have you, the deeper that mythology goes and the more likely it is that they cannot separate themselves from it. This is where we are at. This is what made the 1960s and 70s so traumatic for so many Europeans. Think about what Europeans had to constantly tell themselves about themselves and their people in order to look at themselves day in and day out. Think about the lies that has to continuously circulate in the minds of Europeans in order to reconcile dispossessing native indigenous people from their land, marking them as agents of Satan because their skin is different, because they do not pray to Christ, whom to the native indigenous people and to many Africans was a demon. You judge an entity that is supposed to be divine by its followers. And because these people did not have a love of life, like they said they did, they could snuff out life without even blinking an eye, there were serious people who thought that they worshipped something that was completely evil. And so they wanted nothing to do with Christ. But think about then the lies that you have to tell yourself to dispossess indigenous people, to place and abuse Africans in their stead, to force them to do the work that you don't want to do. But not only that, think about if you don't even own those Africans, the lies you have to tell yourself constantly to support the people who do own those Africans, so that you can live amongst them and not see them as equal to you. The distortion is what I'm talking about here, ladies and gentlemen. And that distortion started breaking apart during World War II, when everything that West Eurasia stood for, all of its preconditions and notions that it took all around the world to conquer one people after another, committing atrocity after atrocity after atrocity, many of which, by the way, are still going on today. Everything that the West Eurasian mind believed in came crashing down onto itself in the Nazis. This is one of the reasons why when I think about the Nazis, I don't just think about the fact that they killed 6 million Jews. Because one, they didn't. They killed a lot more people than that. But two, for Jewish people to act as if this was an ideology that was for that was directed at them and them alone is fundamentally dishonest. Yes, Hitler and the Nazis put them in camps and did horrible things to them. But it was nothing. It was nothing compared to what Europeans had been doing to other black and brown and red people and yellow people throughout the world. And most of the Zionists, most of the Jewish folks throughout that period of time had not one thing to say about it. So it was not just their burden. It came crashing down on them. Which one might ask why? Well, actually, no, I don't have to ask why. I know why. They were looked at as black-white people. They were looked at as having impure blood. They were looked at as being mongrels who had light skin, that they had bred themselves out of having darker skin. So that's why they were gone after. They weren't gone after just because they were Jewish. They were gone after because they were perceived to be black people, brown people, who had lost their color. This whole notion had been playing itself out throughout the world for centuries by the time it came down onto the Jewish head. And instead of understanding what this said about Eurasia, instead of understanding what led to World War II, because there has been many books that have been written about it, but most of them only focus on what happened with Germany in World War I. They don't look at the long-term realities of Germany embodied West Eurasia. It embodied it. Instead of understanding that, as soon as Hitler was dead, Mussolini was dead, the Japanese emperor was dead, they went to playing the same stupid games that had led to the destruction of World War II. And Americans were no different. The political machine that was the Democratic Party immediately started crippling the New Deal. The Republicans joined in afterward. Thus, laying the foundation for a new fascistic arising that rivaled World War II. More, and this is really well documented in a few books that I've read recently or listened to, the wealthy went after the same New Deal. While, thank you to Matthew Stoller for mentioning this in his book, Goliath, while they were encouraging the building up of the same social structures that they were denying to the home population in America, to their home population in America. They were encouraging, this is something that has been almost lost to history. You know the Marshall Plan? The Marshall Plan, ladies and gentlemen, built a lot of the social welfare systems that Europeans now take for granted. The United States was willing to write into existence and pay into existence social welfare systems to prevent, and they wrote this in their memos, that if they didn't build these social safety net systems, these social welfare systems, that it is likely that Europe would descend into another war. So they built these social safety net, these social welfare systems, to prevent that from happening. At the same time, the wealthy in this country were refusing to do that for the American people. In fact, they were rolling back the New Deal. This is what I'm talking about. This is deep, ladies and gentlemen. This is deep. But it's not too deep for us to pull ourselves out of it. I'm going to do my best to tell the truth without bringing you down today. This is difficult for me because I see a lot of negative stuff in all this, and I want to report it to you, and I want you to understand it truthfully. But I also want you to walk away from this knowing that there are some solutions. It's going to take us a while to get through them. But we are going to have to work very diligently over the next 15 to 20 years to instill this stuff, or else I'll tell you what. By the time I'm 60, which is insane to even think about, but in 2040s, this country will not exist. I'm not saying possibly, ladies and gentlemen. I'm saying if these solutions aren't implemented, this country is showing to us that it will not exist, that it will not maintain the structure that it currently holds. I'm going to take a break. And on the other side, we're going to continue this. I am Brother Bob Deese.
When we were younger, we used to sit on my porch and talk smack about girls and professional sports. And there's a lot of things I wanted to say, but never got a chance to find a way. Take a good look at all of our high schools. This is the first reason that I wanna write you. It must be tough when society is messed up. Gotta save money, please don't take it out on us. Do they even know? Do they even know? If I was brave and write a letter to the president and have him pass it to the leaders of our parliament, but for now, but for now I won't say nothing. Now that we're older, a brand new story unfolds about God and the laws that we've always been told. And there's a lot of the things I wanted but never got a chance to find a way. Do they even know? Do they even know? If I was brave, I'd write a letter to the president and have him pass it to the leaders of our parliament, but for now I won't say nothing. From all the kids who would stand in my residence, who see this letter as a statement of our innocence, as for now I'll start with something.
In spite of the chaos and mayhem at the Capitol yesterday, multiple Republican senators still continued with their ridiculous, bogus objections to multiple states' electoral votes, including 6 on Arizona and 8 on Pennsylvania. Prominent defenders of Stop the Steal, Senators Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley, both among those who maintained their objections in those two states. Will this move put an end to their political ambitions, the exact opposite of what they were hoping?
Well, let's see. Democratic strategist, CEO of Pine Street Strategies, Don Calloway, and co-host of the Realignment Podcast, Marshall Kosloff, back to weigh in on this. Good to see you guys. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks.
Thanks, Matt.
Yeah. Marshall, let's start with you. Obviously, you know, people can say whatever they want. This was driven by Hawley and Cruz in particular, and I think Rick Scott as well. It was one of those people who objected to the results by their 2024 political ambitions. And the thesis, the calculus was, you can co-opt this energy that we just talked about in our last segment, and you can use it to more of like a legitimate end by talking about Pennsylvania election law and all that. And those people will then come out, turn out, and remember that you stood with them during a presidential primary in 2024. Given in light of everything that happened today, do you think that this will have an impact on those ambitions going forward?
No, because
we've talked about this before, they're basically just doing the diet version mm-hmm. of stop the steal and those issues. Because we're already seeing this on Twitter. We're already seeing people tweeting, and actually now congressmen, including Mo Brooks of Alabama, tweeting that the Capitol break-in was Antifa. So you can think that yeah. you're going to get rewarded by voters for just asking questions. Mm-hmm. But what the reality is that when you indulge something that literally just is not true, when you just ask questions, for many people who are just fundamentally bad faith, it's not going to work out. And this is the most important thing that I want to comment on the political prospects of these people. This isn't just about a picture that was incredibly poorly timed and a very bad look. I think everyone knows what I'm talking about with Senator Hawley in front of the Capitol, sinking political prospects. This is about a display of horrific political instincts that demonstrate you do not have the skill set to navigate the moment. If you did not realize that this was obviously how this was going to end, yeah. if you legitimately thought the way to adjudicate a complicated debate about different states and voting procedures with this mix of both toxic, bad faith, and even good faith people who are uninformed, you just are not gonna pull this out. And someone like Mo Brooks is always gonna go further right than you, and you'll be just stuck in the middle and it's not gonna work.
Yeah, I mean, these are two highly educated men, Harvard Law, Yale Law, and they managed to make complete and utter fools of themselves. Don, you're best friends with Josh Hawley, right? That's a joke.
It's a joke.
But you are both from Missouri, yeah. and you've encountered him in political context.
I've encountered him. Josh Hawley, until yesterday, was my friend of 15 years. Wow. Josh and I started practicing law together in 2004. We remained in touch over the years, and I've always had tremendous respect for him and just admiration for him as a person. And I am somewhat sad to have to announce to the world, but more importantly to myself, that that is over. As of yesterday, blood is on his hands, and I'm proud of his hometown paper, the Kansas City Star, for telling him that in as many words. I think that Josh Marshall is correct. Josh has made an extraordinarily poor political calculation that shows us that he is not mature enough to not only run the country as president, which he aspires to be, but he's not a serious enough person, despite all of his education and despite all of his raw intellectual power. He's not a serious enough person to hold the seat which he currently holds. I think that Josh has made a very lazy, intellectually and politically lazy decision in which he thought that he could co-opt the 75 million Trump voters by simply being a stand-in and showing, hey, I fought for him, now vote for me. That's a silly, extraordinarily silly decision made by him and some extraordinarily inexperienced advisors who I will not name, but he has done irreparable damage to his own personal reputation and his personal character. Remember, it didn't start yesterday. He lied over the weekend by saying Antifa came out and threatened his home in Virginia. By the way, his home is in Virginia. He doesn't live in Missouri anymore, y'all. But he lied about that. That was not true. There was an extraordinarily peaceful.
I mean,
very
Don, they came to his house. Look, I don't want to litigate.
The annoying part. The Constitution. They did not threaten him.
I agree with you. They didn't bang on his door or anything. I'm with you. They came to his house, and like that's what happened.
Don, can I ask you? I want to go a level deeper with that. Did I call you Don or did I call you Josh? Anyway, Don, can I go a level deeper with you on that? Because I think it's really instructive. You've known him for 15 years. You would have probably described him as like smart, thoughtful, and decent person. Yep. And yet somehow he got caught into, you called it a silly decision. I mean, it's downright dangerous. Like playing with matches, you know, in a country that's a powder keg. How did you think it was gonna turn out? How does a person that you would think of as like a stand-up dude end up in this really despicable place?
In 2010, the Republican Party was taken over by a fringe element known as the Tea Party, which metastasized into what we now see culminating yesterday in QAnon. But we've been seeing these incidents, which are, we have called them isolated, but they have not been isolated over the last 12 years. But that element co-opted the Republican Party, and Republican leadership nationally, locally, has never quite rejected them or openly repudiated them, despite them being representing the worst elements of our society. Why? Because they're willing to vote R instead of D. So they welcome them into the fold, perhaps with their noses held, but they have welcomed them into the fold nonetheless. I think that Josh made a decision when he ran for office in 2016. The first office he ever sought was Attorney General. And when he ran for office, he saw that he had to have that segment of the right or he would not win a primary. and there was no turning back. I hate to sound Shakespearean, but it was a Faustian bargain that he made, and there's no going back from that. And now, in order to serve his ambitions even further, we know that one has to co-opt that element, that fringe element of the Republican Party in order to get to a Republican primary and compete for president post-Trump. Jeb Bush was soundly rejected in 2016.
Yes.
And I think that Josh made a decision that he could be the one to try to appeal to both the Country Club Republicans, by the way, got him here, right? Which brought him into politics. He can be the one to appeal to them and the Trump vote. Mm-hmm. And it was a disastrous decision, which I think, if it has not ended his political career, it has certainly capped his ambition.
Here would be my pushback, though, Don, which is that from what you're saying is then nobody who, you know, who's a Republican should run for office. Because it's like you can't sniff down or whatever at your own voters. I think you should accommodate them. And Marshall, that's kind of where I would ask you is I actually think it is possible to channel the concerns of Tea Party or whatever, win a Republican primary. And also, as you pointed out, like nobody asked for this. Nobody asked Holly and Cruz to come out, be the faces of the move. This was a conscious individual choice. I soundly reject the theory that they would have paid a massive political price for. I mean, Marco Rubio, as far as I know, did not put out a statement on any of this. He just didn't vote for it. I mean, I don't think he's going to pay a price for that. He spoke, right, but I'm saying before that,
yeah.
Before last night, he just didn't address this. Mm-hmm. He also wants to be president, as far as I know. That seems like a fine way to handle it. Or you could be like Tom...
like a cowardly way.
Tom Cotton, I mean, he stood up, and I'll always respect him for what he said. And he said, no, I'm not doing this. I mean, look, he probably wants to be president, too, and it may cost him. So just talk to that about the political... Because I think it is still possible. You can still be a Republican. You can still run for office. You can still even win. You don't necessarily have to sell your soul or whatever that... Like, nobody asked you to take this step.
Yeah, and that's why I'm glad you brought up Senator Cotton's example, who just tremendously impressed me over the past week, because he is the direct reply to folks who argue that you had to do what they did yesterday. Yeah. Tom Cotton is a culture warrior, if there ever was one. He loves doing the Own the Libs thing on Twitter.
Yeah.
He wrote the send in the Army op-ed during the protest last summer. This is not someone who's a squishy centrist country club Republican. Yeah, he didn't do it. And in fact, yeah. He actually wrote the op-ed before the fact, to your point too, Crystal, that said this was not a good idea. He, and this is the part where some, like, I hate when people say like the arc of, you know, the universe bends towards justice. Sometimes that's a cliche. It's way too reductive, but he's gonna be rewarded for that, because the actual thing that he's projecting there is that he's strong. He's strong, he knows what he believes in, and he's not just gonna be wishy-washy trying to sort of pull things off in a, you know, I had a friend last night who's prominent on the right, who texted, at some level, playing 80-dimensional chess is just going to screw you up, right? We're beyond the 5D chess, we're at 80 different dimensions of chess, and Tom Cotton's not playing, and he's gonna, and I genuinely believe he's gonna be rewarded for that.
Go ahead, Don.
I want to object to Sagar's characterization of my statement. I didn't by any means say that you have to make the decision that Josh Hawley did. I said that's what he should do.
Oh, okay.
Consequences for him. By no means do you have to be a Republican, and I hope that the Republican Party is able to get a hold of this and moderate itself. I think that decision is long after we're all retired. But I have a hard time celebrating Tom Cotton. Tom Cotton is a moron who has fomented dissent and fomented division in this country from the moment he came into office in 2014. I will never say Tom Cotton's name without saying Cassandra Butts' name. She was an extraordinarily accomplished black woman who was the nominated ambassador to the Bahamas under Barack Obama, and he stopped her simply because she was personal friends with Barack Obama. Not about qualifications or anything like that, and that is a show of who Tom Cotton is. I could run down his list of offenses since, but I certainly don't think that Tom Cotton will be, I disagree with you, Marshall, for the first time today, he will not be rewarded for not doing this today, because he has an ample record of silliness over his time in the United States.
Well, it does sound like he'll never get Don Calloway in a Democrat vote, but, you know, maybe he will get some Republican votes.
Marshall, I want to ask you one more question about, like, I mean, before this all happened, I really thought, like, if Donald Trump decided he wanted to run next time, he'd probably be the nominee. And not only that, he probably had a decent shot of winning. This is the first thing, usually there's just like, nothing matters, right? I think this actually does matter. Mitch McConnell's done with a lot of the like, normal mainstream establishment Republicans and all the issues I have with them stipulated are done with this. I think a lot of normal people are done with this. I think there is some final split in the Republican Party over this just absolutely outrageous behavior and the completely shocking images we saw yesterday. But what do you think?
Yeah, let's look at what happened. President Trump betrayed Mike Pence yesterday.
Yeah.
Mike Pence, and seriously, Mike Pence has had his back more than any establishment person the past 4 years and beyond that, and President Trump stabbed him in the back. It's been reported that Mark Short, Vice President Pence's chief of staff, has been banned from the White House grounds. Trump is going around telling people, apparently, that he is glad that Kelly Loeffler and Perdue lost because, quote, they didn't support him enough. It's incredible. Right? This is actually the point where the establishment, but this is also the toxic reality here, which is probably going to unite all of us in frustration. The establishment got their judges.
Yeah.
The tax cut was passed. You know, there wasn't as big of a stimulus package as they would have wanted. So what's really frustrating here, and this is what's really frustrating for all Americans, definitely, not to once again sound like a cliche, is that they don't need him anymore. You know, what they're like, well, look, why would we possibly work with this dude who stabs us in the back when he did what he was supposed to do? And that's actually the real tragedy of the Trump presidency. The tragedy here. Yeah, go on, please, Sagar.
I was going to say, my take is he would win the primary, but a lot of people who might have voted. I mean, I was thinking the Mike Pence voter. Mike Pence actually brought in about 20% of the conservative coalition, evangelical Christians and others. I don't think that that's going to fly this time around. And I think that there's already cost the suburban populations in Atlanta, in Nebraska, in Texas, in California. I mean, so many different places where a lot of voters went and voted for Biden. That's just this on steroids this time. And I don't see enough people getting added into the coalition. But apparently we're out of time. Thanks for joining us, guys. It was really thoughtful. Great conversation.
Yeah, appreciate
a terrible
you
day for America. So thank you.
Thanks, Adam.
Thanks.
Coming up, Matt Taibbi is going to continue this conversation when Rising returns.
Thank you. This may be the most important speech I've ever made.
Well, it's about time.
It was a massive dump. And to this day, everyone's trying to figure out, where did it come from? Massive dump.
Wow.
In the Senate. And this is just the tip of the iceberg. Massive dump. And to this day, everyone's trying to figure out, where did it come from? Massive dump.
Wow.
But I went from leading by a lot to losing by a little. We used to have what was called Election Day. Now we have Election Days, weeks and months.
What?
Lots of bad things happened. What can I say?
Wow.
It was a massive dump. Our country cannot live with this election. Right now, we're worried about the present and what went on with an election that we won without question. In Pennsylvania, large amounts of dump. All over the country, dump. Nevada and California said dump. Right here in Washington, it was a massive dump. To this day, everyone's trying to figure out, where did it come from? Massive dump.
Wow.
In the Senate. And this is just the tip of the iceberg. Massive dump. And to this day, everyone's trying to figure out, where did it come from? Massive dump.
Wow.
But I went from leading by a lot to losing by a little. So many got ballots, they didn't even know what they were for. And again, so many received more than one ballot. In some cases, more than two ballots.
What?
If you were a Democrat, we're gonna fix up your ballot, make sure it's perfect. If you are a Republican, don't even talk about it. Can you believe this? The hardest thing I have to do is dump. When they're irregular, dump. Let's go on to the next dump. It's because they know they are hiding. It's a massive dump. And to this day, everyone's trying to figure out, where did it come from? Massive dump.
Wow.
In the Senate. And this is just the tip of the iceberg. Massive dump. To this day, everyone's trying to figure out, where did it come from? Massive dump.
Wow.
But I went from leading by a lot to losing by a little.
As I mentioned, we are not prepared to give that number.
The Biden crime family steals the election! The Biden crime family steals this election!
Fraud.
The media's covering up! The media's covering up! The Biden crime family steals this election! We want our freedom for the world!
Steal
this election. The media's covering up. The Biden crime family steals this election. Use the
interference, fake polls, suppression polls. If you count the legal votes, I easily win. If you count the illegal votes, we can't let that happen. This is a case where they're trying to steal an election. They're trying to rig an election, winning all the key locations. The observers have been kept far away, so far that people are using binoculars very far away. Votes have been in by election day, and they weren't. Votes are coming in after election day. Votes have been in by election day, and they weren't. Votes should be in by election day.
His father voted here twice since he died. Holden, oh my goodness, kind of funny. The game was fraud. One of the things that does involve fraud is not making it possible to inspect. Gee, what happened? Come on, don't be ridiculous. Well, the network's thought Biden was going to win by 10%.
Votes have been in by election day, and they weren't. Votes are coming in after election day. Votes have been in by election day, and they weren't. Votes should be in by election day.
So, hello ladies and gentlemen, I'm back. I'm back. In the wake, and this is actually a section that I'm adding because I wasn't going to talk about this. But in the wake of what happened on in the Capitol, I was watching the coverage offered by Rising. And my hat tips to Crystal Ball, who was genuinely upset about what occurred and seemed to be willing to finally pull out the claws to go after conservatives. That stated, I realized something powerful while watching this one segment, which you just heard. It's titled Panel. Will Hawley Cruz pay for their election certification gambit? What I realized, and by the way, in this segment, Crystal Ball and Sagrin Jetty had on a black Democratic strategist and a black conservative strategist. And it became very evident that Sagar was disinterested in listening to the Democratic black male. He spoke a bit more hostily towards him, but he was very interested in the black conservative, and both of them had a decor which suggested a purposeful alignment against anything that would be critical of conservatism and critical of the people who orchestrated those actions that day. And as I watched this, I realized exactly what the problems facing this country were. And those problems are rooted in not a tribalism created by non-conservatives, but a tribalism that is created by conservatives. Conservatives, let me actually say, not just by conservatives, but by corporatist conservatives. through a media empire, which now captures all of your major media networks in this country. It captures all of your radio stations in this country. It produces Christian-themed material on many levels in this country. They have indoctrinated a large portion of the American populace into thinking in a way that makes any kind of cross-collaborative effort that doesn't enable corporate conservatism, that's corporatism, that's fascism, to come out on top nearly impossible. And this starts from the top down. Now, last year I produced a episode, or 2 years ago, 2019, I produced an episode on the principles of conservatism. And I didn't include it in that episode, which I probably should have, but I found a clip, a speech given by a conservative intellectual describing 10 other principles of conservatism. And those principles were drastically different than the ones that I read you, or at least some of them were. And one of these principles is the belief in rigid hierarchical structures. The belief in rigid hierarchical structures. Well, in a hierarchy, we often think of only one form. We often think only of who is at the top, who is in the middle, who is at the bottom. But in a hierarchy, just like in any organizational structure, you have subdivisions that occur at each level. And what we have failed to often think about as Americans is these subdivisions. Because it is these subdivisions that almost fool us into not believing that hierarchies outside of these subdivisions exist. Now, you might be asking yourself, wait a minute, what is he talking about? I'm talking here about the difference between class and caste. I'm talking here about the idea of ideological alignment. See, we have a caste system in this country. Now, for European Americans, there's two caste systems that they have to worry about because it comes from Europe. But for everyone outside of European Americans, there's one caste system. The one caste system that crosses both European Americans and everyone outside of the European American physiology is race. That's a major caste system. That is the hierarchical structure that most of Anglo-American society is centered around, is race. Now, if you do your research and you go back into the early 1900s, you would realize that in that category of race, you have sub-races. Well, technically, what you have is a hierarchy within those races of races themselves, and then it descends downward. Now, the second hierarchical structure, which acts similarly as race, is economics. And that comes directly from Europe. Now, in the United States, both of those interact. race in economics. If you're European American and you climb from, let's say, lower class to middle class, race doesn't affect you. If you climb from middle class to upper class, race doesn't affect you. If you're non-European American and you climb from lower class to middle class to upper class, race is a constant presence. Then overlaid therein with both of those hierarchical structures, is your political ideologies, which, if you think about it like a road, you have right, you have left, you have the center line, and then you have what they call the fringe, supposedly the fringe, that are the outside of the, you know, the white lines. And you lay that on top of the hierarchy. You'd see that from an ideological standpoint, you could still be aligned as you move up the hierarchy. However, what typically happens, and I don't know if this is part of the system or if this is just how things have evolved, is as you climb, the hierarchy, let's say economically, because that's the one that affects political ideology the most, typically, the space allowed for leftism shrinks drastically according to what level of economic prosperity you are at, while the space for conservative ideology expands drastically, or so it seems. Now, what you also notice is the power afforded to the people who claim left ideologies diminishes, while the power afforded to those claiming right ideologies increases. This now kicks me back to what I was saying about the conservatives participating in this panel, including Sagar and Jetty. They are tribally aligned and believe that it is their tribalistic duty to protect, no matter the consequences, conservative ideology, and thus their right to act on that ideology. What is revealed by what happened at the Capitol is just how deep and how thoroughgoing this alignment, this tribalistic alignment is when it comes to conservative ideology. The work that these media sources have done to connect those pushing corporate conservative ideologies at the top of the hierarchy to those at the bottom is astounding. They have drawn these people, and I'm not going to get into the history of this, I'm just going to look at where we're at now. They have drawn these people into this web of doublespeak and illogical consequencing, connecting them at the bottom of the hierarchy like puppets to those at the top. They've done it in such a brazen and brash way that it is impossible for that type of mind trickery to be reversed overnight. I'm seeing it in my day-to-day life. Trump supporters having almost mental meltdowns because the reality which Trump is projecting to them and the reality which is presenting itself are too contrasting for them. Now, it just so happened that last week, I started listening to and finished listening to the book Frankenstein. And I finished it the Friday before all of this started. And all I've been thinking since this begun, after getting over the shock, was in, I think it was August, I released an episode talking about the dog whistles, which had called home the dogs. I released that episode thinking that other people had clearly seen what I saw. That all this talk about dog whistles finally called home the dog. Many people did not. But now you're seeing it. You're seeing the monster unsatisfied by the Creator, tormenting the Creator who refuses to do what the monster is asking him to do. The question now is, will this realistic story end the same way that Frankenstein ended? That's the question. And it's a darn frightening one, too, because though at the end of Frankenstein, for those of you who haven't read the book, I encourage you to read the book, you know, get past the slowness of it at points. It's a really good book. Though at the end of Frankenstein, the Creator dies and the monster encourages the one left behind that, you know, you'll never hear from me again, I'm going to kill myself, you know, it's over. My question is it really over for this monster? Because, see, I don't believe the Creator is dead of this Frankenstein. I do not believe the Creator is dead for this Frankenstein, for this monster. I heard there's beginning to be a safe group of people to criticize in the media for this. And one person that has not been criticized, which should be criticized, is Rush Limbaugh. All of these people, there's dozens of them, hundreds of them even, created this thing, and now they can't control it. The book that I'm currently listening to while at work is Dracula. Now, admittedly, I'm early into it. I've been intersplicing it with other podcasts and stuff that I want to keep up on. But it is my fear that we have just gone from Frankenstein to Dracula. That the doctor poisoned himself through being bitten by a vampire or what have you. And now flies the night suckling on other people's innocence and turning them into the walking dead. This is my fear now. You have a people now with a tribalistic mind state which are connected in such a way that ponders. It really makes me ponder. If there was a 70-year-long effort to absolutely dishevel, dismantle, and scatter the competing hierarchical structure. And the reason why I say that is because the right wing as it now exists would not be possible if it wasn't for two key decades. The 1950s, which saw the destruction of the real radical left through McCarthyism. And the 1970s, which saw the discreditization of the new left by terrorist actions, which, it's funny, you know, years ago, I was listening to Mae Russell, and in her old episodes, she used to suggest, and Mae Russell died in the late 1980s, but she used to suggest that the various, quote, leftist terrorist groups that seem to appear out of thin air in the United States, that those were likely FBI, CIA collaborative efforts. That a lot of the terrorism executed against the American public was, in fact, constructed to do exactly that, to discredit the left, so that the left would no longer have any viability. Now, if you think about what then happened in the 1980s, this conspiracy doesn't seem far-fetched, because the left in the 70s, having burned a lot of bridges, technically and figuratively, through being seen as a terrorist organization, they had no credibility in the 80s. The only people that had the credibilities were white conservative Christians. And we are now seeing, after 35, 40 years of their credibility, where they seriously wanted us to go. I would encourage you to do yourself a favor. And I was going to play a little bit of it, but I'm not going to do it, at least not for this clip. But to go on YouTube and listen to the Lawrence Wilkerson, W-I-L-K-E-R-S-O-N, W-I-L-K-E-R-S-O-N, Lawrence Wilkerson, and Paul J, P-A-U-L-J-A-Y, interview from this past week, from this week, when the Capitol was stormed. It is a telling interview, and a very revealing one at that. He makes statements which, to me, are still very shocking, especially where he sees things like robotics taking us. And he made a very frightening prediction and statement, which I'll tell you, you really want to check out. This is a man who has worked at the highest levels of defense and intelligence in this in the United States government. This is a man who has worked in and traveled among some of the globe's most wealthiest citizens. This guy knows business. He knows corporations. He knows the government. And some of the questions and predictions that he pondered upon really calls home. Really calls home the mind, is what I want to say there. Finally, I want to end with this. It is clear to me that conservatism under the corporatist branch is metastasizing. The United States is suffering a decline similar to declines experienced by other empires in the world and other civilizations that have come about in the world. The difference is, and I mean this sincerely, it didn't have to be. The question now that must be posed isn't how we salvage what we have had, because we are not going to salvage that. That is dying. We are in a season of dying. You can't stop death. Death happens. In the ancient ways, whether you're talking about the European Celtics, you're talking about I'm drawing a complete blank. Some of the Native American tribes over here, which is where I first saw this at, so I'm sorry. Whether you're talking about indigenous groups of what we call South America, even over to Asia, in the middle of the Pacific and India, they talk about the four seasons and how they relate to life, ladies and gentlemen. In this world, or sorry, in this country, we talk about three of those seasons. We talk about three of those seasons, and I promise I will do a more broader explanation on this, because I think this is important for us to understand. This is where we're going to be for the next decade. This is not going to be over until probably the middle part of the 2030s. So brace yourself. It doesn't have to be bad, by the way. It depends on where our minds are at and if we are ready to do what we must do to get to the other side of this. Anyway, in this society, we talk about three of those seasons. We talk about the spring of life, okay? And this is now you see where I'm going with this. We talk about the spring of life, that time period that could that is best known as probably, you know, your childhood through your early 20s. We kind of reference the second area of life, and I guess to be fair, spring of life can go through your late 20s for some of us. We kind of reference the second one, but we do it by skipping over it. So I'll go to the second one that we definitely reference, which will then help you see the third one. The second one that we definitely reference is the autumn of life, usually 65 and over. Those are your autumn years. The sun is setting. You're getting closer to death. Okay, so the second one that we kind of reference, but we don't talk a lot about, is the summer of life. That's your 30s to your late or your mid 60s, or even your early 60s, depends on who you are. That's when you're going to be your busiest. That's when you're going to get the most done. Now, you know, just like. I live in the Northeast, for those of you who don't know, and so to talk about the seasons is to talk about a very stark reality, even though climate change is changing that. But, you know, spring is drastically different than summer. Summer is drastically different than autumn. Autumn is drastically different than winter. So that has an effect on me. Now, if I live somewhere warmer, you know, it'd be what it would be. But stay with me. So, you get the most done in your summer years. Autumn is the end of your life. And when the sun finally sets, that's winter. Now, these same traditions tell us that life is cyclical. Life is cyclical. So, once you experience the summer of your life, you go into the autumn of your life. Once the sun sets and you cross the solstice in December, or the equinox. Yeah, no, the solstice. I was thinking, okay. Anyway, once you do that, that means you die. That means there's something that happens between that time period and when the sun again rises in the March equinox. We are in a period of death now, ladies and gentlemen. I'm not sure when it started. I'd probably put my hands on September of 2016, or maybe even it's starting now. But we were always going to go through this. This is not something that we can avoid. Conservatives need to adjust to this reality. Because if they don't, they will be the back door, which frightening demagogues come in through. And look, it's already happening. Donald Trump was a warning. He was a warning. If conservatives are not ready to do what is necessary to reverse the damages which they have caused over the last 50, 60, 70 years, it'll be the conservatives that take us into some very dark nights that is going to long extend beyond the rebirth date of this country, which should be somewhere in the mid-2030s. For those of you who are in your 20s and survive this period of time, you will see that by the middle of this century, China's going to be in a world of hurt. But that's another day. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, you can reach out to me. I am your brother, Brian Meredith. See you on the next one. Peace. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again: how the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who finally can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun or a brick or a stone, and they're alive.